Hello and welcome to Vanguard Audiobooks. I'm your genial host, Alex P. Linder, with VNNforum.com, with AlexLinder.com. I've even got my own blog. It doesn't have a specific URL. Well, yeah, it does, but not a name URL. Just you can find it on Blogger if they haven't deleted it. Like before, I used to give my Twitter handle, and I'm no longer on Twitter. I'm on Gab. You can find me. I have a chartreuse serpent as my avatar. Today we're going to do, as part of our learning college and our audiobooks, Libido Dominandi, Sexual Liberation and Political Control by E. Michael Jones of CultureWars.com, one of America's foremost Catholic intellectuals out of South Bend, Indiana, where this was published in 2000 by St. Augustine's Press. We are going to do Part 3, Chapter 20, Washington, D.C., 1983. So this has gone through a couple thousand years of Western history, or at least since the French Revolution. I'm getting this confused with his other book. Yeah, this is the one that goes from the Illuminati in the 1700s forward. Anyway, we've got about 30, 40 pages left. This will go about average length, 13, 14 pages. 570 to 584. Let's dig in. Again, Part 3, Chapter 20, Washington, D.C., 1983. In May 1983, Judith Reisman, then a recent PhD in communications who was on the faculty doing research at the University of Haifa in Israel, was guest on a talk show hosted by right-wing pundit and former Nixon aide Pat Buchanan. During the course of the discussion, Reisman indicated that the sexualized portrayal of children in magazines like Playboy was leading to an epidemic of copycat child abuse by juveniles and adults. One of the listeners who found her claims intriguing was Alfred Regnery, son of the conservative publisher Henry Regnery, again of German descent, thought Germans were getting a raw deal, German-Americans, and founded his publishing company sometime, I think, in the 40s. Anyway, they went on to be the ones that have funded, like, basically the stuff behind Richard Spencer and some of the stuff behind Kevin MacDonald and Jared Taylor. So that's the connection here you should know about. Regnery money, non-Jew publisher, published some... Actually, it's published a lot of neocon stuff, but it's also backed some of what is now called alt-right stuff, as I speak in 2017. So, Reisman is a sex researcher and a Jew. She goes on Buchanan's show. Alfred Regnery, son of Henry Regnery, hears her, and he had just been appointed head of the United States Department of Justice, Justice's Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention. The OJJDP had a budget to subsidize research, and since Regnery had no desire to give out grants to what he considered the same old left-wing network, which had received them in the past, Reisman seemed like just the person to give impetus to the Reagan shakeup of Washington politics. Reisman met with Regnery and other Justice Department officials on May 24th, and they assured her that they were interested in funding research which could establish a, quote, causal relationship between sexualization and violence involving children in mainstream pornography, that's a direct quote, but told her that she should locate a university to administer the grant. And typos in here. When she mentioned this to Jack Martin, the owner of a Texas publishing house who was interested in her work, Martin responded by saying that he was a friend of Richard Berenzin, then president of American University. Some of you may know what may be coming if you remember how he worked out back when I was out there. Martin felt that Berenzin would be interested in the project. It was a feeling which turned out to be true. In early June 1983, Martin arranged a meeting between Reisman and Dr. Robert Norris, vice provost of the university, who indicated that the university was, quote, quite enthusiastic about what they considered an important project, which also, not coincidentally, had the prospect of important government funding attached to it as well. Norris concluded by informing Reisman that she could count on being appointed to a full research professorship with free tuition for her children once the funding had been approved. Backing up what Norris had conveyed verbally, the university notified Reisman in a letter dated August 31, 1983, that she had just been appointed full research professor. Then, after a period during which everything fell in place in a manner that approached the miraculous, things started to go wrong. Because she was a neophyte in the particularly vicious political struggles which characterize the area where government money and academic ambition intersect, Reisman wasn't aware of what was going on until it was too late. Reisman had been born Judith Ann Gelernter in 1935 in Newark to a family of German/Russian Jewish communists of the sort that might have attended one of Alexandra Kollontai's lectures when she arrived in New York during World War I. And we've heard about her in earlier chapters, kind of the head of the free love in Russia movement, even though not a Jew, actually. Unlike Kollontai, the Gelernter family, who were involved in the seafood business, drew a clear line between left-wing politics and sexual liberation. Reisman remembers a mother who welcomed her home every day after school, and a father who loved her mother, and a family who arranged impromptu musicals around the family's piano, where they listened to her Aunt Mary, who had rejected an offer to sing with the Metropolitan Opera, sing Yiddish and American folk songs. The musical culture of the Gelernter family eventually rubbed off on Judith, who went on to become a vocalist and producer of music segments for educational television, PBS, the Milwaukee Public Museum, the Cleveland Museum of Art, and Captain Kangaroo, a popular children's program in the 50s and 60s. Christ, even I remember that. It lasted longer than the 60s, I do believe. The family idol continued into Reisman's own family and only ended in 1966 when her then 10-year-old daughter Jenny, as well as other neighborhood children, were sexually molested by a 13-year-old neighbor boy who had been sexualized by repeated exposure to his father's collection of Playboy magazines. Seeking support or at least an explanation for what had happened, she spoke to an aunt who told her that children were, quote, sexual from birth. When a classmate from Berkeley told her the same thing, she began to wonder who the source of this idea was. It was then that Judith Reisman made her first contact with the work of Alfred Kinsey. It wouldn't be her last. So she has a personal motive for trying to find out the origins of this, the promoting of this bizarre sexuality that's affected one of her relatives. On July 23, 1981, Reisman delivered a paper entitled The Scientist as a Contributing Agent to Child Sexual Abuse, a preliminary study, in which she brought up, for the first time in the 32 years since it had been published, the material on child sexuality in tables 30 to 34 of the Kinsey Mail volume, and wondered how this data could have been obtained without involvement in criminal activity, that is, where they're talking about babies and orgasms of young kids, and they're obviously sexually abusing them. And we have already heard that they had this on tape, and that he dealt mostly with pedophiles and prisoners and homos, and used grants from Ford and Rockefeller, or Rockefeller at least, to tape these people actually molesting children. Before giving her report, Reisman had written to Mail Volume co-author Paul Gebhardt to ask about the data in tables 30 to 34. Gebhardt wrote back saying that the data had been obtained from parents, school teachers, and some male homosexuals, including, quote, some of Kinsey's men, who had used, quote, manual and oral techniques to catalog the number of orgasms they said they could stimulate in infants and children. Virtually the entire sex industry, sex research establishment worldwide was in attendance at the meeting in Jerusalem, but the reaction to the talk was silence, stunned or sullen or otherwise, until a Swedish reporter wondered out loud why the assembled experts had nothing to say. The silence was understandable. Just about everyone in attendance had cited Kinsey as their mentor, and some even knew about the criminal activity involved in Kinsey's research. They all knew that Kinsey's research was the basis of their science, which is to say the legitimizing basis for everything they did. Kinsey was the foundation of that house of cards. If what he had done could be discredited, it threatened the sexual empire which had been built since his death and upon which they all depended for a livelihood. Later, when word got out that Reisman had government money to pursue her thesis and show a link between Kinsey's exploitation of child sexuality, quote-unquote, and Playboy, Penthouse, and Hustler's exploitation of the same thing, stunned silence turned to determined, if behind-the-scenes, action. According to Reisman, quote, the Kinsey Institute had secretly threatened American University with a lawsuit if I was allowed to carry out my study. Reisman discovered this and other facts when she deposed June Reinisch, then head of the Kinsey Institutes, when she attempted to sue the Kinsey Institute for defamation. Unaware that any movement against her was afoot, Reisman began to notice problems with the actual disbursement of the grant shortly after it had been awarded. On August 22, 1983, Pamela Swain, Director of Research and Program Development at OJJDP, wrote to Regnery informing him that the Reisman Project was no more than a limited survey of research literature, which could be accomplished by OJJDP for approximately $40,000 to $60,000. From July until December of 1983, Robert Heck, Reisman's OJJDP program manager, told her on several occasions that he was encountering unusual administrative delays. In order to expedite the implementation of the grant, Heck deleted all references to Playboy, Penthouse, and Hustler, and any indication that those magazines might contribute to either sexual abuse of children or delinquency, in spite of the fact that it was part of her original mandate to examine them. Then on December 22, 1983, Reisman was told Congress that Congress had approved the grant to explore, quote, the role of pornography and media violence in family violence, sexual abuse, and exploitation and juvenile delinquency, for the amount of $798,531. With the grant finally approved in December of 83, Reisman met with AU's American University's Director of Contracts Administration, Stanley Metelsky, on December 27, 1983, only to learn that AU is now having second thoughts about being the sponsoring institution. "We don't know if we want to go ahead on this grant," Metelsky told Reisman. "We're not sure we want to sign it." When questioned about the abrupt change in attitude from the enthusiastic reception her idea got in June, so from June to December, American changed their mind, possibly as a result of threat from Kinsey to file a suit, Metelsky said that columnist Jack Anderson had called AU and was investigating the grant and apparently intended to do a negative article on the project. As a result, Dr. Anita Gottlieb, head of the AU Public Relations Department and a one-time associate of Anderson, recommended that AU drop the grant because the university did not want unfavorable publicity. Commenting on the expected adverse publicity, Metelsky indicated that an individual, quote, higher in the university was in agreement with the recommendation to drop the grant. At around this time, Gordon Rayleigh, staff director for Congressman Ike Andrews of North Carolina, became involved in the story when he called AU and said that the Reisman Project was illegal, quote-unquote. James Wooten, OJJDP deputy administrator, would later say that Judith Reisman was simply a pawn in a war waged by people who were out to get that Al Regnery because of his conservative views, but the vehemence and the magnitude of the attack indicated more was at stake than the job of one political appointee. At stake was the credibility of the sex education and pornography industry, because all of them were based on Kinsey, and now Kinsey was under attack. The method of attack was to portray Reisman's grant as a waste of taxpayers' money, something that would discredit her project to the conservative audience, which would otherwise be favorably disposed to what Reisman had to say about the effects of pornography. On February 6, Jack Anderson made good on his threat and wrote an article which appeared in the Washington Post and was syndicated nationally, calling the Reisman Project, quote, another scheme that stinks of voodoo science. On February 20, 1984, USA Today ran an article based on a January 19 interview with Rayleigh, who said, quote, I have never seen a grant as bad as this, nor an application more irresponsibly prepared. Given the billions of dollars the government had already poured into every form of pork barrel research imaginable, the vehemence of Rayleigh's statement went beyond mere hyperbole. Something big was clearly at stake here, and it wasn't the fiscally insignificant sum of $800,000. The grant was finally approved for dispersal on February 10, but Reisman's troubles were far from over. Encouraged by the attacks in the media, Rayleigh scheduled judicial subcommittee oversight hearings on the OJJDP and Reisman's grant for April 11, 1984. Once American University received the money, Reisman began to experience the same sort of delays from their grants department whenever she attempted to obtain the administrative support necessary for the project. Her efforts to talk to President Berenson were rebuffed when Dean Frank Turaj, T-U-R-A-J, informed her on May 16th that all communication with the president would have to go through him. Frank Turaj. At around the same time, Myra Sadker, the woman who had signed the letter appointing Reisman full research professor, resigned and was replaced by the new dean, David Sansbury, who announced on his initial visit to Reisman's office that he felt that the results of her research might be used to stifle the First Amendment freedoms. At this point, the one-handed magazines got openly involved in the fight. In July 1984, Playboy ran a feature attacking Reisman, Fat Grants and Sleazy Politics, Reagan's Porn Paranoia, in its August issue, calling Reisman's project a Big Brother censorship program. 1 month later, Larry Flynt, then in jail fighting an obscenity charge, penned a similarly derogatory piece in Hustler. Newspapers like the Atlanta Journal and USA Today did similar pieces, as did the Monitor, the publication of the American Psychological Association. Shortly after the Playboy article appeared, Senators Arlen Specter, Republican, Pennsylvania, and Howard Metzenbaum, D. Ohio, both Jews, and Edward Kennedy, Massachusetts, held Senate hearings on the grant, which involved questioning not only Reisman, but also Richard Berenson and Dean Frank Turaj of AU, as well as Alfred Regnery, James Wooten, Robert Heck, and Pamela Swaim of OJJDP. Reisman's staff, already under pressure to meet their deadlines, were frightened and harassed, and she was threatened with dire consequences unless she appeared before the Oversight Committee immediately. During these hearings, Specter would ask leading questions of the following sort. Do you have any intention of abandoning the project as a result of these proceedings? He also demanded to see child pornography, and when Reisman handed him a Chester the Molester cartoon, Specter, ignoring the title, claimed there was no molestation in the cartoon, even though the same cartoon was used to help convict its creator, Duane Tinsley, of incestuous abuse of his daughter several years later. According to Susan Trento, quote, no one would help Reisman prepare for the hearings. As a result, Reisman went into the hearings unaware of what their true purpose was, which, according to Trento, was that the politicians were posturing for the press. Which press, she doesn't say, nor does she say who the press represented in this struggle. Later, after Reisman learned that Howard Metzenbaum had been interviewed in Penthouse, she felt he should have acknowledged this conflict of interest and recused himself. AU President Berenson begrudgingly defended Reisman on academic freedom grounds before the subcommittee hearings, but back at AU, actions were being taken to gut the project, or at least to restructure it radically. As soon as AU signed the grant, the AU Institutional Review Board demanded that Reisman not examine or refer to Kinsey's work in anything she did with her grant money. On September 10, Myra Sadker and Frank Turaj met with Reisman and presented her with a new organizational chart for the project, one which now put Sadker in overall control of the program. Sadker was now also named research director and first author, in quotes, of the project design. Reisman refused and threatened to sue. On October 9th, AU Provost Milton Greenberg met with Reisman to inform her that the university was now only proceeding with the grant reluctantly. He also made clear that he felt there was no proof of that what was portrayed in the pages of Playboy, Penthouse, and Hustler had any effect on behavior. All your colleagues, Greenberg told Reisman, read these magazines, so, quote, no one will listen to you, no matter what you find. Following the attacks in Playboy and Hustler, Reisman's grant was reduced to $200,000, but even this didn't satisfy its critics. On December 10, 1984, Gordon Raley was quoted as saying in a UPI article that, quote, the scope of this project should have been reduced a year ago, and it should have been reduced to zero. Shortly after leaving his position as subcommittee staff director in 1985, Raley wrote an especially critical article attacking Reisman, entitled Reisman's $734,000 Thrill. The article appeared in Penthouse in a November 1986 issue, along with the type of graphics Reisman was criticizing. Reisman, R-E-I-S-M-A-N. In the meantime, the same unfavorable press, including a front-page article which appeared on May 3, 1985 in the Washington Post, continued unabated. Under the cloak of fiscal accountability, the press was calling for what amounted to prior censorship of research, and failing to get the grant canceled, they did their best to discredit the results before the research had been complete. At first glance, the reaction seemed out of all proportion to the stimulus, But then it became known that the Reagan administration was about to promote a major anti-pornography initiative of its own, and the attack on Reisman could be seen as a preemptive strike on something bigger just over the horizon. The purpose of the media attack was to trivialize any concern with pornography as a waste of the taxpayers' money. On May 13, Raley was quoted in Time magazine as saying, "We don't need a study to determine that child pornography is bad. We could use some assistance in doing something about it." What Raley neglected to say is that Reisman was involved in documenting the use of children in the big three one-handed magazines, Playboy, Penthouse, and Hustler, and it was doubtful that Raley wanted to help attacking them, especially since one of his articles had appeared in Penthouse. Then the reason for all of this defensiveness became apparent. On May 20th, 1985, newly appointed Attorney General Edwin Meese, and boy did they hate him in the 80s, the left just was incensed about him calling him a pig. Meese called a press conference at the Department of Justice in Washington, D.C. in May 1985 to announce the members of the Attorney General's Commission on Pornography. The new commission was called into being a year before when President Reagan signed into law the Child Protection Act of 1984. According to Meese, quote, "The president made this request in response to the many complaints about pornography that had been registering throughout the nation. The purpose of the commission is to reassess the impact of pornography on society over the past 15 years, especially in its increased violence and the spread of pornography to other media, the video recorder, the VCR, the telephone, and even the computer." Even the computer, he said in 85. How funny is that? Shows you how quick technological and social change can be just 10 years later when the internet became mainstream. Even the computer. Among its objectives, the Meese Commission was to, quote, "determine the nature, extent, and impact on society of pornography in the United States, and to make specific recommendations to the Attorney General concerning more effective ways in which the spread of pornography could be contained, consistent with constitutional guarantees." Among other things, the scope of the commission included a review of available empirical and scientific evidence on the relationship between exposure to pornographic materials and antisocial behavior, and on the impact of the creation and dissemination of both adult and child pornography upon children. Since that seemed to be a reference to Reisman's project, all of the commotion over one grant suddenly became clear. The sexual dulling that goes on with pornography had progressed by 1985 to the point where the only thing the average citizen got upset about anymore was child pornography. Hence, if there were to be any curtailment of the spread of porn, it would have to be based on the indignation which the exploitation of children caused. The commission was to terminate 1 year from the date of the first commission meeting. That was held in Chicago on July 24th and 25th, 1985. 10 days after Attorney General Meese announced the formation of his pornography commission, AU Provost Greenberg called Reisman into his office to tell her that, under no circumstances, would she be allowed to work at her grant beyond November 30th, 1985, cutoff date. Reisman was also notified that her Xerox equipment would be removed by November 27th. On October 29th, Reisman was informed that she had to get the grant done 2 weeks sooner than the deadline Greenberg had given her in May. So she's being harassed always. Now we have the very unusual situation of a Jew going against the Jew system, and the system with the broader view in mind of unstringing Aryan society by spreading pornography will sacrifice the little Jew who, for personal reasons, got off on what they would see as the wrong track. That's how I would interpret this as a white, from a white nationalist point of view. In the end, Reisman completed a draft grant report on schedule in late 1985, in spite of the fact that AU changed the deadline on her, reducing the amount of time she had still further, and despite the friction and problems among her staff due to both external and internal harassment. She was forced out of AU immediately upon delivery of the report. However, the draft remained at AU for clerical editing before it was mailed to the project peer group for comments, corrections, and additions. Instead of editing Reisman's document, AU took 9 months to rewrite her report. The gutted AU version, with the peers' confused criticisms, was then forwarded to the Justice Department, where Vern Spiers, S-P-I-E-R-S, the new OJJDP administrator, lost no time in announcing that the study they had commissioned was rejected due to multiple serious flaws. Regaining access to her report for 9 weeks, Reisman began the painstaking task of reading and correcting the 1,600-page report, putting back in what AU had taken out. It would have been an impossible task for a lone researcher to accomplish, but Reverend Jerry Falwell heard of her situation and flew Reisman and her papers to Lynchburg, where he gave her access to secretaries and a graphic artist. Since AU locked Reisman out of her computer disks and her data files, over the next 9 weeks, by diligently checking her original hard copy against AU's gutted and altered version, all of the data were re-entered, rechecked, and the document recreated. Although Reisman had salvaged AU's promise that all of her materials would be delivered to the Attorney General's Commission on Pornography no later than January 31, 1986, the materials were never delivered. In January 1986, shortly after Reisman was forced out of her position at American University, Sanford Unger, a journalist who had worked for public radio, was appointed dean of the AU School of Communication. Unger did not have a degree in communications, which makes his appointment as dean seem somewhat odd to Reisman when she heard about it. But eventually the reason for his appointment became clear when Unger emerged that summer as a spokesman for Americans for Constitutional Freedom, the front group which the Media Coalition, i.e. the masturbation industry, had set up to fight the Meese Commission. Americans for Constitutional Freedom. Reisman claims that the appointment was part of a deal by which wealthy prospective donors would give money to the AU School of Communications. In the summer of 86, Unger, who I'm pretty sure is a Jew, would appear on the McNeil-Lehrer news program representing Americans for Constitutional Freedom, which he described as, quote, businesses and individuals who are concerned about some of the aftermath of the Justice Department's Pornography Commission. People who are worried about this sort of hysteria, the current frenzy over pornography, and the attempt to start intimidating people to remove perfectly lawful materials from stores, libraries, classrooms. Right around the time Unger was appointed dean at AU on January 21, 1986, Linda Borman testified before the Meese Commission in New York. During her testimony, she described being kicked and beaten during the filming of Deep Throat, Miami, as well as being held in bondage by Chuck Traynor as a prostitute. Perhaps sensing just how devastating Borman's testimony would be, the masturbation industry organized a preemptive strike a week before. On January 16, 1986, Betty Friedan and other prominenti organized a press conference that eventually got released as a pamphlet entitled Against Censorship. Isn't that interesting? The top feminist takes the side of the pornographers because they're all Jews and thick as thieves. In attendance, oops, I think I missed a line there. On January 16, 1986, Betty Friedan, Jew, and other prominent people, organized a press conference that eventually got released as a pamphlet entitled The Meese Commission Exposed, Proceedings of a National Coalition Against Censorship. In attendance, in addition to Mrs. Friedan, were Kurt Vonnegut, non-Jew, Colleen Dewhurst, who eventually became head of the National Endowment for the Arts, the NEA, and Harriet Pilpel, probably a Jew, of the ACLU, because it sounds like Pilpel, who made a career of defending Alfred Kinsey long after the man was in his grave, threatening to sue Pat Buchanan for a column he had written about Reisman's expose of the deceased sexologist. Kinsey was not a Jew, but his bogus science was promoted by Jews. Friedan, who made a career out of portraying herself as sensitive to the needs of women, not only ignored the testimony of women like Linda Borman, who were tortured for the nation's sexual titillation, but actually blamed them as traitors to their sex by collaborating with the Reagan administration in general and Attorney General Meese in particular. In fact, Friedan, ignoring the testimony of women who were both degraded and physically injured as a result of pornography-inspired sexual experimentation, outdid herself by claiming that, quote, suppressing pornography is extremely dangerous to women, said the old hag. Just why this was so, she never got around to explaining. Not that Ms. Friedan likes pornography. I find a lot of it very boring, she opined, but I recognize the rights of others who choose to be titillated in that way. even evidently for the trajectory of pornography, by this time had made it clear if the torture and death of women were necessary to gratify that wish.
"You know," Ms. Friedan continued, "some pornography certainly does degrade women. It also degrades men, and it degrades sex. The pornography that pushes violence is particularly deplorable, but the forces that want to suppress pornography are not in favor of suppressing guns."
The non sequitur about guns notwithstanding, what the Meese Commission and the unfortunate ladies who testified there had learned the hard way was that pornography generated an inherently unstable psychic trajectory that began with illicit sex, sex outside marriage, frequently ended in torture, and sometimes ended in death. Friedan said in her statement that, quote, "the ultimate obscenity in America was murderous violence," without the slightest indication that by 1986, the evidence about the source of murderous violence and libido emancipated from morals was all a matter of public record, the very record which Friedan's testimony hoped to suppress. The pimp, one escapee from white slavery told the Meese Commission, made pornography of all of us. He also made tape recordings of us having sex with him and recordings of our screams and pleading when he gave us brutal beatings. It was not unusual for him to threaten us with death. He would later use these recordings to humiliate us by playing them for his own friends in our presence, for his own sexual arousal, and to terrorize us and the other women he brought home. By 1985, all of the brutality and personal tragedy associated with 20 years of liberation and almost 30 years of liberalized obscenity laws had begun to flow into the public consciousness, and once it became apparent that pornography was not a victimless crime, people were willing to act on what they had learned. On April 10, 1986, the president of Southland Corporation, owner of 4,500 7-Eleven stores nationwide, announced that it would no longer sell Playboy, Penthouse, or Forum magazines in its stores. The letter also made clear that Southland was basing its decision in part on Judith Reisman's report before the commission's hearing on child pornography. Reisman's testimony on images of children, crime, and violence in Playboy, Penthouse, and Hustler had been given to the commission on November 12, 1985, 2 weeks before she had been driven out of her offices at AU. And what I had alluded to earlier, I don't know if he's going to get to it, Berenson at AU ended up being busted for like making obscene phone calls. It was a very odd thing, so I don't know if he talks about that in here. Anyway, so she turns her stuff over there. She's harassed and all that, but still puts out a big report and turns it over to the Meese Commission and basically gets the job in at least one corporation. Southland, that owned 7-Eleven, got rid of the top three one-handed magazines. 4 days after the announcement, Reisman was called into Jennifer Murphy's office. Oops, let me back up. I missed a sentence or two. Southland's announcement caused such a public furor that other major drug and convenience stores, as well as many mom-and-pop stores, followed suit, announcing that they too were no longer going to offer Playboy and other one-handed magazines for sale in their stores. 4 days after the announcement, Reisman was called into Jennifer Murphy's office and told that the university was very concerned about the 7-Eleven letter. AU had been editing Reisman's report since November without her input, and Murphy was concerned about how the information might be used. It was clear now that both Reisman and the Meese Commission were considered a major threat to the masturbation industry's profits. As a result, the industry decided that press conferences with Betty Friedan were not going to do the trick. What they needed was a much more concerted effort. The Media Coalition, capital M and C, needed help in staging an across-the-board assault on the Meese Commission, one that would involve front groups, which could take on the mainstream media and divert attention from Reisman's findings and all of the horror stories people like Linda Borman were telling. The new strategy involved direct contact with decision-makers and was designed to influence them with friendly persuasion. Friendly in quotes. On May 16, 1986, Playboy Enterprises filed suit in federal court against Attorney General Meese and members of the Attorney General's Commission on Pornography. In July 1986, an article by Sanford Unger attacking Meese appeared in the July issue of Esquire, a Jew-owned publication. In it, Unger characterized Meese as a small-town Rotarian who was out of his depth in Washington politics. Worse still, Unger implied that Meese wanted to be accepted by the very people who held him and his ideals in contempt. After leaving public radio, Unger worked as the head of a public relations division of Gray & Company, a Washington lobbying agency. Both Meese and his wife Ursula were close personal friends with President Berenson of AU. Both Meese and Berenson were friends with Bob Gray, president of the already mentioned Washington public relations firm, and it was to Gray & Company that the masturbation industry turned in its hour of need. The counteroffensive was swift in coming. On May 30, 1986, Alfred Regnery resigned as the head of the OJJADP. On June 5, 1986, less than 2 months after Southland Corporation announced that 7-Eleven would no longer be selling one-handed magazines in its stores, Steve Johnson of Gray & Company wrote a letter to John M. Harrington, Executive Vice President of the Council for Periodical Distributors Associations, thanking him for their meeting a week before. In that meeting, attended also by Gray & Company Associates Frank Mankiewicz, he was a big political operator back in the 70s, and Ray Argyle, Johnson and Harrington discussed the problems, both potential and actual, which the Meese Commission, which was scheduled to release its report in less than a month, posed to the publishing industry, as well as strategies, both long and short term, to discredit the commission. The publishing industry had formed an ad hoc committee called the Media Coalition to combat the Meese Commission's efforts. Membership of the Media Coalition read like a who's who of the publishing industry and included the American Booksellers Association, the Association of American Publishers, the Council of Periodical Distributors, the International Periodical Distributors Association, and the National Coalition of College Stores, which meant that some of them had a direct financial interest in the sale of pornography, a fact which came up in the Johnson letter when he said that the financial interests of the Media Coalition would have to be disguised by transferring the attention of the public to First Amendment issues. Reframe it as a not as a porno profits issue, but as a free speech First Amendment issue. That this was not going to be easy or cheap became clear when Johnson began discussing the cost of the project and arrived at a figure of $75,000 a month as his initial estimate. Moreover, Gray was apparently only one of several PR firms hired to help the Media Coalition. Working with ACLU lawyer Michael Bamberger, this same group, along with the Freedom to Read Foundation, the ACLU, the Association of American University Presses, the NYCLU, and St. Martin's Press, which later published Wendy McElroy's Apologia for Porn, XXX, had filed an amicus curiae brief, a friend of the court brief, in 1981 in favor of the defendant in the Paul Ira Ferber child pornography case. The same group of organizations, again under the leadership of the ACLU's Mr. Bamberger, sued the city of Indianapolis after it passed an ordinance designed by Catherine McKinnon, the feminist, which recognized pornography as sex discrimination. Johnson makes clear in his memo, however, that the effectiveness of the Media Coalition was limited by the perception that all they were really interested in defending is their own financial interests. Quote, creation of a broad issue-oriented group and selection of a national spokesperson, according to Johnson, would help dispel the notion that the opponents of the Commission's work are only interested in protecting their own financial interests or are somehow pro-pornography. As a result, Johnson suggested that the Media Coalition select, quote, a national spokesperson not directly involved in publishing, because that would help opinion leaders, policymakers, and the general public understand that the issue here is not pornography, but rather First Amendment freedoms. But again, the First Amendment doesn't have anything to do with obscenity. It has to do with political opinions. This group, under this impartial spokesperson, would include academicians, civil libertarians, so like college professors, civil libertarians, religious leaders, civic and community leaders, politicians, business and foundation executives, authors and editors, columnists, commentators, and entertainers. This new group might be called Americans for the Right to Read, or the First Amendment Coalition. William Buckley later wrote that Gray & Company had called him about the pornography issue, giving some indication that the plan was eventually put into effect. Eventually, the Media Coalition settled on the name Americans for Constitutional Freedom, an organization which Susan Trento describes as One of those covert activities that Gray and company were so good at setting up. Dummy front organizations, use a nice neutral term. The Gray and Company plan, according to Johnson, would focus on the following strategy. First and foremost, it would deny that pornography is, quote, in any way a cause of violent or criminal behavior, which was, of course, the gist of what women were saying when they testified before the Meese Commission. The wave of women's stroke books, to be discussed in detail later, which appeared in the 90s, were a development of this same theme, funded by the same industry which was paying Gray and Company $75,000 a month to discredit the Reisman and the Meese Commission. During the 90s, instead of claiming that porn does no harm through the medium of a public relations firm, the industry was paying women to write books in which they claimed that porn helped them to become sexually autonomous by freeing them from dependence on men for their orgasms. Secondly, the Gray and Company campaign against the Meese Commission would claim that pornography, quote, diverts our attention from real economic and social problems. And finally, it would claim that the whole Meese Commission was, quote, orchestrated by a group of religious extremists whose tactics and goals are clearly not representative of mainstream public opinion. Now, Porky's 2 came out about this time. That's with Miss Ballbricker type on that theme. So they use their Hollywood to attack it, too. In addition to the public relations campaign under the direction of Frankie Mankiewicz, Johnson also proposed in his letter an attempt to influence legislators directly through Gray and Company's chief lobbyist, Gary Hymel, H-Y-M-E-L, who served as, quote, former top aide to House Speaker Thomas P. Tip O'Neill. There was a big shot in the House for many years if you're younger. And could therefore promise, quote, knowledge of and access to the legislative and administrative decision-making process. In a final flourish that is either fatuous or brutally cynical, Johnson assures Harrington that Gray and Company's lobbying staff is accustomed to working with our public relations staff in orchestrating national grassroots campaigns on behalf of our clients. Maybe that's what they call astroturfing today. The purpose of the campaign was to generate the illusion of widespread grassroots support, when in fact Johnson himself later admitted in his letter that the Meese Commission's findings and recommendations will likely find widespread public acceptance. In a society which claimed to be democratic, it was essential to cloak the financial interests of those who profited from exploiting sexuality behind a facade of grassroots support. Mendacity was essential to manipulation of this sort. Without it, the manipulation would not work. The memo was also a good indication of how the political system worked in the United States, but beyond that, it was also an indication of how commercialized lust functioned in that system. The essence of a republic is devotion to the common good. The essence of empire is power, the power not of the people, but of one faction over another. Just as the republic needs virtue in order to function, the empire runs on lust. Empire is politically organized appetite. Each faction strives to use the power of the state to gratify its own desires. As politicians succumb one by one to the lure of money to ensure their election and re-election, the order of the state becomes determined by those who pay the highest price for it. Those with the most money control appetite. So to ensure that they stay in power, they promote unfettered appetite, feeling that the ultimate outcome of what are essentially financial transactions will be in their favor. Wilhelm Reich felt that only socialism could lead to sexual freedom, and that unfettered sexual freedom would lead to socialism. It turns out that he was wrong. Capitalism was much better at exploiting sexual appetite, and the political system it created is much better at turning unfettered appetite into a form of political control via economic exploitation. In the 90s, unfettered appetite meant charging a price for what used to be free. It meant the reduction of all aspects of life to a form of consumerism. It meant promoting bondage, both spiritual and economic, in the name of freedom. Ultimately, the followers of the Enlightenment believed what Augustine said when he claimed in City of God that man had as many masters as he had vices, but not in the way that Augustine said it. The Enlightenment simply reversed the values while espousing essentially the same concept. The Enlightenment promoted vice among its victims as a way of becoming both their economic and political masters. Plato was right. Freedom of this sort did lead to slavery. Sexual liberation was a form of political control. His subtitle. At the same time that the PR campaign was getting started, the purges continued at OJJDP. By June 16th, James Wooten was gone, forced to resign, and shortly thereafter, subjected to an FBI investigation to intimidate him further. Wooten was replaced by Pamela Swain, who had leaked her memo criticizing Reisman's study to the press in August of 1983, shortly after the project had been approved. The campaign to discredit the commission reached its culmination in July of 1986, when the Meese Commission issued its report, and Attorney General Meese, at the urging of Bob Gray, distanced himself from the very report which bore his name. The former California prosecutor, according to Trento, renowned for his toughness, actually agreed to stand up in public and say that Playboy and Penthouse were not obscene. He said he had read Playboy in his youth. As soon as he was made to see the folly of it, he very quickly disengaged himself, is how one Gray and Company executive put it. It made Meese a laughingstock. He added, in spite of their efforts, or perhaps because of them, Gray and Company went on to receive grants from the Justice Department to promote some of the department's other programs. The Meese report relegated Reisman's research to a three-line footnote. The Meese report could not find one mainstream publisher for its final report until a cookbook publisher reprinted the findings to make them accessible to the public. How about that? On or about November 10, 1986, Pamela Swain admitted to Judith Reisman that although AU had held an order to work for 9 months, OJJDP was going to release her gutted report in 3 days. Reisman was given 3 days to deliver her corrected original report to OJJDP. Pamela Swain had indicated in response to a phone call from Dr. Reisman that the report would have to be released to the public and press by OJJDP 10 days after its receipt under the Freedom of Information requirements. This was, of course, untrue. On November 13, 1986, Reisman delivered 4 corrected copies of the 1,600-page report to OJJDP administrators Vern Spears and Pamela Swain. The reports came complete with 5 full peer approval reviews and letters. Instead of being pleased their money was not wasted, however, within 24 hours, avoiding Freedom of Information rulings, Mr. Spears had turned over the 4 copies to AU for disposal. Only the uncorrected copies would be released to the public by OJJDP, and it was on the basis of these versions that it was roundly condemned by the press. I mean, how much skullduggery is there going to be, for Christ's sakes? On October 29, 1991, the next OJJDP administrator, Robert Sweet Jr., described Reisman's research as, quote, a sound study, producing high-quality data in a complex and difficult area, conducted in a scientifically acceptable fashion. In early November, the Justice Department tried to reach a settlement in the Playboy suit by offering to issue a statement claiming Playboy had never been found obscene. The statement was essentially meaningless. Obscenity, which had always been under the police powers of the state and had never been protected speech under the First Amendment, had been conflated in Roth and subsequent decisions with pornography and, as a result, had lost its meaning as a legal term. Following Roth, the state could prosecute cases of hardcore pornography, which was only one class of obscenity, but even these prosecutions would cease once the Clinton administration took office. Playboy, however, sought additional concessions. Shortly after the DOJ made its settlement offer, Meese publicly stated that he had read Playboy and Penthouse as a young man and that he didn't regard them as obscene. 4 months after the attempt to settle the case, in March 1987, Meese told a crowd in Philadelphia, "In my opinion, there has not been any court that has held Playboy or Penthouse to be within the Supreme Court definition of obscenity. And I don't feel that those are the kind of things that should be subject to prosecution under the law." Meese here was clearly referring to the revised view of obscenity, which had been introduced into the law with the Roth decision, and not the traditional definition found in Regina v. Hicklin, which claimed that, quote, "The test of obscenity is this, whether the tendency of the matter charged as obscenity is to deprave and corrupt those whose minds are open to such immoral influences, and into whose hands a publication of this sort may fall. A traditional obscenity definition. The conservatives had adopted the premises of the Cultural Revolutionaries. That, coupled with the peer pressure Washington could exert when its base of power was threatened, caused Meese to repudiate the report, which bore his own name. So he totally cucked on that, we would say today. On November 19, 1986, Howard Kurtz, the Jew media critic of the Washington Post, announced that, quote, serious flaws shelve $734,000 study. A few days later, in a Chronicle of Higher Education article, George A. Comstock, appreciate the irony, professor of public communications at Syracuse University, someone who had been called in to evaluate the project as an outside expert, said AU had tampered with the Reisman report, omitting key findings that Reisman had included in a draft. Comstock, actually, that's not ironic because he's doing what his namesake would do. Comstock said that American University wasn't really committed at all to seeing this completed. The Chronicle concluded that bad publicity had made the university uncomfortable. If so, the university was in for a good deal more discomfort in the immediate future. In May of 1990, AU President Berenson was arrested for making a series of 30 to 40 obscene phone calls to a 33-year-old local woman who had responded to an ad Berenson had placed in a local paper offering child care. During the course of his conversations with the woman, Berenson had not only discussed, quote, in gross detail, having sex with children, quote, but also offered children to me and my husband as sex slaves. Berenson also discussed in graphic detail his extensive collection of videotaped child pornography. On May 23, 1990, Berenson pleaded guilty to two counts of making obscene phone calls in Fairfax County District Court. As part of his rehabilitation, Berenson checked into the Sexual Disorders Clinic at Johns Hopkins Hospital, home of Dr. John W. Money, the man who testified in 1973 that viewing a film like Deep Throat, quote, could have a cleansing action on people's sex lives. In spite of his conviction, Berenson received a $1 million settlement from AU and remained on as a professor. Isn't that just lovely? And that ends that chapter. So that's the story of Judith Reisman attempting to study link between porno and child abuse and other physical attacks on women and such, and the mainstream establishment's response. Thank you for being with me today, and I'll be back with you again real soon, and we'll do part 3, chapter 21.